Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Muchas gracias.
And Bob Hill, welcome back from Peru.
Again.
We are in the midst of a couple of weeks of enjoying some of the contacts Bob made while he was on holiday there. And today, what do we get to talk about?
Yeah, we get to talk about the Inca Indians, the Inca cultures. And you know, sometimes you visit places and you kind of forget about them. But seeing those incredible terraces and those irrigation systems that were built 1,000 years ago or so just sticks in your mind like a dart.
It is the foundation of the history of agriculture, isn't it?
It is. Absolutely
it's
is.
It's amazing.
And we got a guy today who's going to tell us all about the culture and some of the agriculture, too.
It's good.
Steph DeHaan, he's with the International Potato Center, which I visited when I was in La Molina, which is just outside Lima, Peru. And it's just a fascinating place to just to go back and walk up a 12,000 feet and imagine people gardening there 1,000 years ago and dealing with problems that they're dealing with today in many ways.
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of come full circle in a lot of ways, too.
Almost, it's like the closer you stay connected to tradition, the better off you are, and the further you go from it, or, you know, as other things around you change, it makes you realize that the system can break down when you start removing parts of the pieces.
And there'll be lots of photos I took while I was there. It'll be on our website, so people will be able to see and share with it. Did not get to go to Machu Picchu, thank you, but I'm going to go back someday and do that because of the floods wiped out the railroad. But just being around those mountains, and I can't forget it. I just it just sticks in my mind all the time.
So I think we'll get a little bit of a feel of that when we talk to Steph DeHaan, who's an agroecologist. And also we're going to talk with Wynn Dunwell. He's with the Nursery Crop Research Station out in Princeton with the University of Kentucky. Wynn's a great guy. He's going to talk about the Theodore Klein Plant Awards, of course. Theodore Klein is a well-known plantsman from Crestwood, Kentucky. That's where Udell Gardens is now, in fact, his home and nursery. So worth preserving, worth remembering his name and his contributions, and that's one of the things that they're doing with the Plant Awards. So we'll find out what the 2010 selections are for this year, Bob, when we talk to Wynn in just a little bit. So, Bob, in the meantime, what is going on in your garden?
Two things. I've got peony angst and azalea agony.
Agony.
Yeah.
Not peony envy.
I never thought of it that
Sorry
way.
Sorry about that.
I don't want to get into that right here at a public radio show.
So you're ready for your peonies
to bloom? Well, I moved
my
peonies last year. I transplanted them all.
Okay.
All of them because they were too much in the shade.
Okay, so you're nervous.
You know, this too deep, too high thing.
Right.
And I walk by them every day and I'm talking to my plants.
I know, come on, guys and girls.
Come on. So I'm still a little worried they might be a little too deep, and I'm not going to know until flower time.
Yeah.
And of course, azalea angst or agony is something else that you don't plant them much because they are so tricky. But I've got an area in part shade that gets a lot of water under pine trees.
If they don't grow, perfect.
If they don't grow there, they ain't going to grow.
Yeah, give it
but
up.
But it takes azaleas a couple of years to get established and be happy. So I'm walking around out there saying, come on, peonies.
So this year, the year is supposed to be the time, enough time has gone by that they should be established.
Or
right?
I buy a condo in Hurstburn.
Oh,
and
I know you would do that.
About the Wish Estate, what's up?
So bad news,
oh,
and
no.
also sort of like some interesting things to consider.
Okay.
You know how I was ready to burn my asparagus this year?
Yes.
Guess what?
They don't burn.
They don't. We got the little our weed flamethrower thing out.
That problem.
And I'm ready for, because I'm thinking it's going to help control the weeds that are always there, kill any asparagus beetles that are overwintering, that sort of thing. So it doesn't work. Okay, and then I go and the next morning I have an email from a Homegrown listener, and she had brought up a really good thing to consider. Because she said, I understand you want to burn your prairie, but, have you thought about the ecological, environmental implications of burning, 5 acres?
Yeah.
And does it really matter in terms of the health of the prairie? Everybody that's a prairie grass person says that you should burn them every couple of years for the health of the prairie. But, it's more to think about, Bob. You know, doing one thing, what's the ripple effect in another way?
But I think about that when I burn, because I burn wood all the time. I'm burning clean, hard wood.
Yeah.
I don't worry about it. And there's got to be some give and take in this world.
Yeah.
I mean, if nobody ever burned anything at any time, What would you do?
Well, and like for our wood-burning stove, it's a Buck stove, and it actually is efficient at throwing out heat, right? Yeah. And my thermostat's at 60, so...
So you're saving oil
so
and
I'm saving something,
fuels
but,
and stuff?
But I'm just saying it was a really good comment because mm-hmm. we have to consider and weigh all of these things. Where do you give? Where do you take? And be reasonable about everything.
Yeah, but
I don't know what the answer is.
Well,
but
a good prairie gives back in a sense, mm-hmm. doesn't it give back?
It
and
does.
Wildlife and mm-hmm. happy birds and right. happy bugs and right. maybe gives even some oxygen, I don't know, back to the air.
But the comment has made me,
I can tell.
You know, want to seek out some more answers and ask a few more questions myself. So
you can buy a condo next to me in Hirschman.
Well, I certainly won't do that.
Maybe two doors
I'll just
down.
Lay down in the prairie before I do that.
Okay.
Anyway, so that's what's going on. Asparagus does not burn, and maybe that was serendipitous because one less thing that I actually ended up polluting, and I'll have to cut it back by hand. All right, Bob, there's a couple of things on the calendar. For the folks that usually buy herbs and perennials at the Farmington Historic Plant Sale.
Yep.
This year they're doing something a little bit different. They're still having their plant sale, but they're only going to be able to do it through a pre-order form, and then you go and you pick them up. So it won't be that traditional plant sale anymore. But the pre-ordering needs to be done before Monday, April 5th, and then the pickup is going to be April 17th. Just go to Farmington's website at historichomes.org or go to our website at wfpl.org for more details on that. But only pre-order for the Farmington plant
sale. Makes it easier in a lot of ways.
Sure it does.
When you think about it, yeah.
Yeah.
Also, probably the greatest gardening event in history.
Are you a part of it?
Yes.
I figured.
Yeah, the Lanier Mansion Foundation in Madison, Indiana, is having a garden affair on Saturday, March 20th. The two speakers will be Louisville radio host and columnist Bob Hill.
Oh.
He'll present Wit, Wonder, and Whimsy in Your Garden. I better get to work on that.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Larry DeBurr, executive director of Rivers Institute at Hanover College, will discuss great botanic gardens of North America.
Great.
Wow.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it'll be on our website. It's, again, a Saturday, March 20th, two fabulous speakers.
Starts at 10:30.
And goes till 3.
All right. Sounds good.
With a lunch thrown in.
All right. And if you have any garden-related events, just let us know. You can email us at homegrown@wfpl.org, and we'll get it on the air, and we can post it on our website as well. Another website that you might find useful, you can look up a whole list of plants from previous years that have won the Theodore Klein Plants Award at the University of Kentucky's website. Just look for Theodore Klein Plant Awards. But we've got the 2010 award winners, and Wynn Dunwell is joining us to talk about that today. Wynn is a University of Kentucky Extension Horticulture Specialist for nursery crops. He's located at the university's Research and Education Center at Princeton. Each year, he helps to select plants for the award that promotes superior plants for Kentucky landscapes. Wynn, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Sure, it's always a pleasure. All right, this particular award is in honor of Theodore Klein. Can you give our listeners who aren't familiar with Theodore Klein an idea of what kind of legacy he has left to horticulture locally?
Well, most of us knew him, mm-hmm. Even of the younger group of people in the industry, and he was just a true plantsman through and through right up till the day he died. You know, some nurserymen retire and go do other things, or they just stop doing nursery, but he never did. He was always into plants and always around plants people, and was basically, because of his exquisite selection of plants and his gardening and his landscape designs and other activities over the year, he definitely was someone people listened to.
Uh-huh.
Well, yeah, he was digging in burlapping trees in his late 80s.
Right, sure.
Sit there and watch him do it.
Sure, yeah. Sure. We also know he was a creative and artistic person.
Mm-hmm.
So that adds to his plant selections over time that most of us feel very strongly about plants that he was interested in, and we selected some of those.
Mm-hmm.
Nordman fir is not anything special to Theodore, except he liked it.
Right.
And he made sure everybody knew of plants he liked. So he was just a very special man.
Yes. So there's a plant award in his honor, clearly deserving. How are the plants selected when? I know that you're part of the group of people that choose the plants each year, but what's the criteria? What are you guys looking for?
Well, basically, we're looking for a plant that is dependable, something that occurs in Kentucky and in surrounding areas and has been a reliable performer and has outstanding ornamental characteristics. And, of course, we select both a perennial and a woody, but I before this call, of course, I'm trying to be prepared. I looked back through all of our selections, mm-hmm. and other than a few cultivars, all the genus and species hold true from 1999 right up to now as plants that I would recommend people put in their yard. So if you wanted an outstanding landscape, you could go from on our website, uh-huh. and so pick from those award winners, and you couldn't go wrong. So that's what we're trying to do. And it's difficult because you want to be sure. There's so many plants, new cultivars and new plants coming at us these days, and they're all with great merit. At the same token, you know, we want to be sure it performs well.
Consistently.
And so we look to find the plant in different landscapes and different places and try to be sure that it's a plant that will perform well for most people, not everyone. Of course, there's plants for shade, plants for sun, woodies, big trees, small trees, shrubs. So there's lots of different things that might not work for everyone.
But now, when you say we, it's a panel of people who look at like 20 or 30 plants and then pick the five or six that are named? How's that
well,
work?
We have a group of plants people. That's who we try to put on there that represent different areas of interest. You know, Mike Heyman is, journalism.
There's trouble.
in photojournalism.
Yeah.
And Steve Foltz would be public gardens.
Sure, at the zoo.
Tony Nold at the Plant Kingdom is just, you know, the ultimate in a plant lover.
Right.
And has been a leader from the beginning, wanting this to represent the ideal of Theodore Klein. Mm-hmm. Paul Capiello, new Pierce people, Kevin Collard.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, a couple of us visited his place in Leachfield and said, holy smokes, here's a wild man.
Yeah, he is. You know? That's a great place.
I mean, he's very enthusiastic. Of course, he's a lover of boxwood.
Right. Yeah.
So we do have to put him in the true plant geek.
In spite of that, he's a pretty good guy.
Yeah, right. Bob, you've pinned it down. But, you know, we try to pick people who also are interested enough to be very active in the group. And Mary Van Annen of Gelato Seeds has just added a whole new perspective on the perennial part.
Mm-hmm.
We basically had a bunch of woody people picking perennials.
Okay.
Now with her, we got somebody who flat out knows her perennials and really, really has made an impact in our selection process.
Well, yeah, speaking of perennials, let's begin with one of the Dixie wood fern.
That's a wonderful plant. I'm really excited about that selection, actually, because the two parents, as you all know, are natives in Kentucky. So we're talking about a true native plant. And then the hybrid is also occurs naturally all along the eastern part of the southeastern part of the United States, and it has a very broad range, and it's a very productive plant. And Ralph Archer at Whitehall, who's got his fern collection there at Whitehall, just spoke so highly of it and reinforced it so much that I got a little verbose on our web page, and I'll apologize for that. But talking to Ronald Jones at Eastern Kentucky University, who put out the book Plants of Kentucky, Native Plants of Kentucky, Plant Life of Kentucky, I'll get it right sometime today. He believes that hybrid, the Dixie wood fern, actually probably occurs in Kentucky. It's just no one's found it yet.
Mm-hmm.
So it also could be, and there's a very high probability that it is a Kentucky native. But as a fern, you know, most people think of wet areas. And Ralph has indicated this plant grows equally well in dry sun as it does in dry shade, as it does in wetter areas. Just it affects its size.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very versatile fern that many people might start growing some ferns by utilizing this plant. Mm-hmm.
Another, I was excited to see when that you had Rob Spurge, the Euphorbia robbii. In fact, Bob Hill, gosh, I want to say 8 years ago, gave me a little piddly dug-up division out of his garden, and now I have a nice big collection in my own garden of this particular spurge. Let's talk about this.
Plus, our son is named Rabbi. He is Rabbi. We had to have it. We just had to have it.
Well, you all know these plants as well as I do, and truthfully, the pictures on the website are from Mary's yard.
Uh-huh.
I actually don't have it here at Princeton, so as a 2010 project, we're going to include it in our plant theft of the day. But in any case, it's just so striking, and it one of those plants that performs so well and spreads so nice.
Right.
And the glossy foliage, the foliage itself, you know, I don't... The flower is okay, but truthfully, it's one of those wonderful ground covers that mm-hmm. happens to flower. Like mm-hmm. One of our early collections with Dianthus Bath Pink is mm-hmm. a nice one, too, for that.
But I like the flower of this because it's, you know, that iridescent sort of euphorbia tradition. It's great in cut, like, in arrangements.
Sure.
And it's not like your typical flower, if you will, you know?
Sure.
So it's pretty cool that way.
Yeah, I like it, too. I haven't cut it, mm-hmm. but now that you've mentioned it, I do insist on flowers in the house mm-hmm. year-round.
Mm-hmm.
And it does have that light airiness to it.
Right, and it lasts.
Which is very typical of some of the plants that we grow as natives.
Mm-hmm.
So it does add that factor
so
to it.
So sun or shade for this great ground cover?
I know it'll grow in dry because that's I'm always looking for plants that'll grow under maples.
Mm-hmm.
But it does seem to perform better and spread better if it has irrigation or mm-hmm. some moisture.
Mm-hmm.
But I've mostly seen it in shade.
Yeah. All right. Sounds good. All right. I know this is a favorite of Bob's, the lacebark pine.
Yeah.
I tell you what, I wanted to go to Dawes for 30 years, and I finally made it. And those ones they have there, that silver ghost, shows up from about a half a mile off.
Mm-hmm.
And it's stunning. Now, not all of them have their bark so trimmed, the branches trimmed up so it's so obvious from such a distance. But to me, it's just an exquisite plant.
So, how does this particular pine differ from, you know, the average white pine that can sometimes succumb to drought and wind and other types of problems?
Well, of course, it is a pine, so I assume some of those things might be a possibility, but it's the thing I like about it is it tends to be multi-trunked, and it tends to be tolerant of different conditions, such as it'll grow in moist soils. I've seen it down at Cheekwood, mm-hmm. where it's down at a lower area,
mm-hmm.
and
Nashville,
seems to grow fairly well there. At Dawes, it's up on a high area. And those two areas are like two temperature zones, north to south, and cover our area very well, Kentucky east to west. So I think they will perform really well here. The only thing is, of course, any plant that we overuse, or if we put it into some of these environments, industrial environments or stripped off soils where we just have rock or even tight, fine textured soils, it might have difficulty there, as would any plant.
Right.
But
yeah.
Otherwise, I've seen them to be very versatile.
Yeah, the tricky thing for this for me was it's got this incredible bark. You want to see this green and cream and olive exfoliating bark, but you have to prune it pretty heavily to show that off, which is not something you normally do to a pine, but in this case, I had to do it.
Sure. That's the way I feel about it, too.
Yeah.
After I saw those ones in Dawes where you could see the bark from so far off, and I'd always seen it in botanic gardens like the National Arboretum before, where they'd allowed it to branch almost to the ground, you got to rummage through to see the bark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So limit up.
And the bark is worth a special effort to raise it up. I think, doesn't Udell have some of their exfoliating bark pines are are limbed up to show the bark. And this multi-trunk feature also is very nice in and of itself.
Then you've got the Chinese fringe tree, which I also love because it tends to bloom more on the tip than inside, and I actually prefer the flowers of that than I do to the regular.
I'm hard-pressed. I truly love them both.
Yeah.
You know, Virginica, our native, as well as Retusis. But after you've seen the what I'll call, you know, what the Durr calls the southern form with the rounded, glossy leaves, and the there's the thing that's so wonderful about these for the average homeowner is you buy a little teensy plant, it's going to flower. You know, it flowers almost from a cutting.
Yeah.
And so you have a very good show as a small plant, and then as it gets larger, its flowers are so dense. And they last quite a while, too. And this is another plant that you can see over a very diverse number of zones. Even though it's called the southern form, I've seen this, the rounded, glossy leaf one grown in Ohio without any problem. And Steve Foltz has had it for many, many years at the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanic Garden.
Yeah, I've got exfoliating bark on mine, too, which is a plus to it.
Really?
Yeah.
So Chinese fringe tree, or Ceananthus retusus,
right,
which is a relative to our native species. Does it bloom the early, really early, like our native fringe tree, or is it a little bit later?
I have seen them blooming together in collections.
So still pretty early then.
So, and it grows a little purple, dark black fruit that people can actually grow their own plants if they're trying to do that type of thing. And it's just a spectacular plant. Occasionally you get on the southern form, the rounded leaf one, you'll get a rank shoot that takes off and you need to trim that back and get it into form. But once you've seen this plant, you will covet it. There's one at the gate at the Atlanta Botanic Garden that's about 30 feet tall of the southern form, which tends to be shrubby and round and dense. And it, after I saw it, I immediately went and got one.
Yeah, called all your friends.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I got a shovel.
So it's a spectacular plant, but I'm never going to, I like them all. I even like the northern form, the narrow-leafed, long-leaf one, and wouldn't scare anyone away from that because at Wave Hill in New York, they're 40 feet tall, and when they bloom, they're just wonderful. Wonderful.
All right. Acornis florida made the list as well.
Right. Appalachian spring.
Appalachian spring flowering dogwood. The native dogwood has kind of gotten a little bit of a bad rap in the last couple of years. People are encouraging people to plant the Coosa types. So it's good to see the good old-fashioned dogwoods making a comeback.
Right. Well, this is an interesting plant. Of course, having Paul Capiello, dogwood author, on the committee was helpful because, you know, I'm easy. I have two plants I absolutely love, and after that, there's some more. So it was helpful having Paul discuss this one with us. And the key to this one is if Discula, you know, the dogwood anthracnose, is going to be a major problem, or is going to move into Kentucky, then we need a plant that will tolerate that. And this one was selected from an area that was totally, all the dogwoods were killed, and here's this one plant. So that is a plant that it would be very valuable to us in Kentucky.
Great.
And it's a pretty bloom and good foliage, and the fall color, I understand, is outstanding.
So that's all we want in a dogwood, to be sure. So what color are the blooms, Wynn?
Well, they're typical Acornis florida. They're white.
White, okay.
They don't overlap like some of the ones that people would recommend, like Cloud 9, which is an outstanding plant for Kentucky, has overlapping petals. Gives it a denser feeling. But I like they have a little curve to them, which is typical of the native seedling types I see in West Kentucky, where they have the little cut in the end of the... End of the petal, and then the petals tend to twist a little bit. And so it gives a very, very good appearance to the fact that it is a disease-resistant mm-hmm. selection from native population.
More traditional somehow.
Right, yes,
sounds good.
Exactly.
Well, we will definitely look to the Theodore Klein Plant Award winners in helping us select more great plants for our own gardens. We appreciate your all's efforts. Thanks a lot, Wynn.
Thank you.
Thank you all. I can't talk enough about this program, yeah. So I'll just have to let you go.
All right.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Wynn Dunwell is a University of Kentucky Extension Horticulture Specialist for Nursery Crops at the University's Research and Education Center at Princeton, Kentucky. The award is sponsored by the University of Kentucky, the Kentucky Department of Agriculture, the Kentucky Nursery and Landscape Association, and Udell Gardens, the home, garden, and nursery of the late Theodore Klein. It's located in Crestwood, Kentucky. And, of course, for more information on all the plants we talked about today, you can see our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up after the break, we return to Peru for a visit to the Inca culture and agriculture. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
This is Mathematics Whiz Bob Hill.
All right. So here's a question for you, Bob. Mm-hmm. You've been in Peru where
yes,
they talk to look at things a little differently
yes,
in many ways.
Higher.
So a little higher, acreage-wise, too.
Yeah.
The hectare, what is the conversion between a hectare and an acre?
2.5 acres to the hectare.
All right.
Yeah.
So there you have
and
it.
And that becomes important in a sense because we're going to speak to a man
yes,
who speaks
does.
In hectares, but he speaks about them very well. He's Steph DeHaan. He's an agroecologist with the International Potato Center in La Molina, Peru. He's got 13 years experience in Peru in crop genetics, plant morphology, and, of course, the Inca culture and social networks. He's with us today from La Molina to talk about the history of agriculture in Peru. Steph, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. Your resume indicated you grew up in Holland, went to schools in Holland. And how'd you end up in Peru?
I went there for a practical period in 97. And I stayed for half a year to study Andean roots and tubers, the Oca, Mashua, and Oyuco.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I got a job offer, and through Dutch Development Corporation, went back, worked for 5 years in agricultural development projects, and in 2002 started to work in the International Potato Center.
Well, great. And then, of course, you know, when I was there, the Inca culture is what people talk about mostly, but that's just the last in a whole series of cultures. So kind of take us through historically what led up to the Inca culture in Peru.
Well, I think in the Inca culture, they always separate two big time horizons. The first one was more a local dynasty around Cusco, which was typical, I think, around that time in the 1200s, 1300s. You had lots of smaller empires,
mm-hmm.
from central Peru to northern Peru, and what made the Incas different as an ethnic group from the rest is their organization and their ability to combine the best of the cultures they conquered,
mm-hmm.
to keep on expanding. But their empire, as you said, was very short. It only lasted about 300 years.
Mm-hmm. So, Steph, is it fair to say that the organization, you know, politically, socially, and otherwise, does that have much to do with the fact that they did master the art of agriculture and cultivation so they could store larger amounts of food, therefore they could concentrate on sort of expanding their empire as well?
Yes, yeah, definitely. I think the Incas, what they brought to the bigger picture was first skills of building roads.
Mm-hmm.
They built Capacñán. Then the cultures which they conquered, they were never left to starvation, so there was always sufficient food. And they had these storage places called colpas, which you can still find throughout the Capac-Ñan, which goes all the way from Argentina to Colombia. So there was always enough food and always enough storage. Hmm. The other thing which they mastered very well is the what some anthropologists call the vertical archipelago. So instead of having isolated ecological zones, each with their own products, they mastered the integration very well between the different ecologies, so that the lower zones where you have fruits, cotton had access to meat and potatoes, which came from higher production zones, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So people had access to all the basic products they needed. Agriculture, of course, the domestication of all the crops they used, and even the development of the infrastructure, the impressive infrastructure like the terraces and the canals. A lot of that knowledge they took from the cultures they conquered.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because talking about the infrastructure of the roads, and like you think about food distribution today and like trade routes, and you forget how important the infrastructure for the movement of the food. You know, if that's not there, then it doesn't matter how much food you've got if you can't get it to all the outposts, right?
Yes, exactly.
Huh, interesting. Yeah.
And those incredible terraces and irrigation systems I saw, and there'll be photos of these on our website for our listeners. Do some of those predate the Incas and they just barred them, or were they added on to during the Inca culture?
They were improved during the Inca culture. So basically the center of Peru, which is the present department of Lima, the province of Yauyos, that's generally where the archaeologists date the original culture of terraces.
Okay.
And that goes back to about 700 after Christ.
Wow.
And till now, that area is still the area which has the biggest land area covered with terraces. That was a completely different culture. That culture was called the Yauyos culture. It was a culture which split off from the Wari culture, which was the big pre-Inca culture, which also expanded from Ayacucho north and southwards. The style of that kind of terraces and also of the canals is very different. You might say it's more primitive compared to the Incas. The Incas they refined it much more. For example, the sizes of the stones and the perfection of how the stones fit together. That's really really different. I think it was one of the strengths of the Incas was to pick the best of all the cultures they conquered. Mm-hmm. And that's also true for the terraces.
And then when the Spaniards came, there it was all gone in 100 years or less, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, the first big impact, of course, was the demographic collapse.
Right.
That was basically caused by diseases.
So, Steph, some of the terraces that are used today, have they been continuously used, or is it just the technology is newly employed for the agriculturalists of today?
What you see today is, first, a lot of the terraces in Cusco, mm-hmm. they've become protected by the INSA, which is the National Cultural Institute. So the farmers who live in those areas, they're not even allowed to grow anymore on the terraces.
Okay.
And then in central Peru, where you have the origin of the terraces, the farmers still use those terraces from the year 700, 800.
Wow.
They're still actively used.
Wow.
And the maintenance is done a lot through what they call faenas, which are communal labor parties.
Okay.
But the times I've seen those communal labor parties, the people restore the terraces, but they actually don't build new terraces anymore.
Okay. So how do they deal with fertility issues in terms of using these terraces over and over and over again?
Okay. There's often within a single community, you have different kinds of fertility management mm-hmm. systems. On the terraces, often they're cultivated the whole year round, and year after year.
Okay.
And even in the case of maize, there is no fallow at all. it's incredible sometimes when you talk to entomologists or people who work in the pests and diseases, how people have been cultivating maize, which is generally known as a very, very extractive crop, for centuries without any fallow. A lot of the races are also adapted, apparently, to that kind of a system. But that's what farmers nowadays, they call it maisal, and those kinds of systems, they have no fallow at all. Huh. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have what they call sectorial fallowing systems. They're often natural pasture lands above 3,900 meters.
Mm-hmm.
They go around the community and they're divided in different sectors. And generally, the fallow breaker is potato, followed by quinoa or by barley.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
And then after the communal fallow, it's left fallow for 5 to 7 years.
Okay.
The interesting aspect of that system is that when it's cultivated, the whole community cultivates only in one sector, and when it enters into fallow, it's used as pasture land.
Okay.
By fallow, you mean it's no longer in use then, right?
But used pastorally by the animals.
Yes, it's only used as pasture, but it's not used for cropping anymore.
Okay.
Good old crop rotation. What about fertilizers? Are they still natural from the animals, or do they bring in chemicals these days?
Of course, once the roads get there, and you also get input suppliers, but still a lot of the higher farms, they mostly rely on guano de corral or just manure.
Mm-hmm.
In combination with fallow.
Now, are these crops just to feed themselves, or are they able to sell any of these things to export any at all?
Depends also on a bit on the region and the kind of farmer. Most of the farmers in Peru are small-scale farmers with less than 1 hectare to grow on. They typically destinate 80% of what they grow to home consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And about 20% either to barter or to for sales. But then you also have a smaller group of farmers who have a bigger amount of land, and they do participate in the market.
Mm-hmm.
But
majority are sustainable. So
the export crops are only quinoa and a little bit of the giant maize from Cusco.
Okay. So, Steph, the land that you were talking about before that was communally held, communally worked, and then, you know, left fallow for 7 years for pasture, when the community works those and, like, harvests those crops from those fields, the bounty is communally held as well, or you're just harvesting for your own family in those instances? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a hybrid between private and communal, in the sense that the decision making is made at the communal level. So the village president and the authorities, they decide in which sector people are allowed to cultivate that year.
Okay.
And there's also community control on that. But then every family has its own plot within the overall sector.
Okay.
And they are responsible for planting and for harvesting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your resume indicated you also spent some time working with aromatic and medicinal plants, getting them to market, like produced by the Incas. Is that a crop that they actually can sell?
Yes, that was one of the motives to work on medicinal and aromatic plants, because they have a higher value.
Mm-hmm.
It's a brand of aromatic herbal teas.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Based on about 15 native species, and they're consumed basically by people in Lima City. It's a bit of a more expensive brand compared mm-hmm. to the other brands in Peru. But yes, the medicinal and aromatic flora in Peru is quite large. It's mostly used still for home use in traditional medicine. And there is a potential to bring that to the market as a higher value product. Personally, I think that there's a lot of underutilized and underexplored potential in the native crops beyond the potato and beyond quinoa. You have different other native crops like the amaranth. Some small projects in southern Peru have been exporting them to Germany for organic cookies, amaranth cookies. Another option, of course, is the medicinal flora. You also have some root and other root and tuber crops. You might have heard of maca. It's a crop which grows above 4,000 meters. It's a very micronutrient-rich crop. It's used a lot by people who practice sports. I think those kind of crops could be given more attention.
Well, Steph, the whole phenomena at farming at 12,000 feet just amazed me when I was there. I saw these beautiful fields, but how do you get the crops from the fields? I mean, is it on llamas and mules, or how do they get them back to market?
Oh, yeah, well, you still have a lot of what they call yamichus. So in the more isolated places, you typically have that exchange between agricultural communities and more the cattle communities. And then typically in May or June, people would come down in some areas in Peru still with their herds of llama. And then generally it works like that. For every 5 or 7 bags they transport, they keep on themselves. That's more in the isolated regions. And then, of course, as soon as you get roads, then you get more car transport also.
Right. So is it growing? Are you optimistic that this is going to happen? There'll be more of markets and more crops with the natives way back in the up in the Andes?
There are two sides to the coin. No,
right.
I think first priority still, especially for those farmers living with less than 1 hectare, is still food security.
Right.
So, and I think that the rural development community in Peru should still target especially child malnutrition. And often in the highlands, that's not so much protein as is often thought, but it's particularly micronutrients like iron and zinc. So really that should be the first priority. And then second priority, I think, is markets. Of course, in a globalized market, how much can you compete with less than a hectare?
Right.
One has to be realistic also, and that's the difficulty, just because of the economy of scale, that such small farmers in such isolated conditions are in a very difficult position to compete. On the other hand, I do believe that if they're going to participate in the market, they will have more of a chance, a competitive advantage, if they work with native crops rather than with barley.
Yeah.
Or other crops which are introduced from outside, and where other farmers in other countries can be much more competitive.
Well, Steph, thank you. It's been fascinating, and we appreciate your time.
Yeah. Thank you very much for the interview.
Steph DeHaan is an agroecologist with the International Potato Center in La Molina, Peru. For more information on his work, or to see photographs of the Andes Mountains where he's doing his work, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and a new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
And Bob Hill with a question or two for Miss Wishy to begin with, anyway.
All right.
These are great questions because it's a new gardener. I'm excited about this.
I know. I can't wait to go.
I know. Lady's named Katie. This year, my husband and I will be planting a vegetable garden for the first time. We are specifically having trouble with our garden layout. Is there a reliable website or book that you can suggest where I can get a companion planting guide to assist us in this process?
Okay, website. Again, going back to our great resource from the University of Kentucky and the Extension Service. Go to their website, Department of Horticulture, and they have a great guide that literally is, you know, your home vegetable garden guide.
Right.
You can just access it via the website, or you can print off the whole publication and have it handy. It'll give you pretty much from A to Z and plant-specific, vegetable-specific, you know, information. So it's great. Another source, and I have this book out all summer long in terms of designing crop rotations, you know, having things pretty, basically. And we interviewed her a couple of years ago, but Jennifer Bartley, and she wrote a book called Designing the New Kitchen Garden, an American Potager Handbook. And I love this book because she gives you ideas on how to create a seasonal garden, something that will provide interest all year round, also practical elements as well. So University of Kentucky website, and then Jennifer Bartley, her book Designing the New Kitchen Garden is my recommendation. Yep.
In fact, that book inspired us partly to get our vegetable garden going.
Yeah, it did.
Outside the kitchen.
Yeah, yeah, good.
It was better in theory than in practice, but, but we're working on it.
You're working on it.
We're working on it, yeah.
You're working
okay.
on it.
Katie, another question that's also interesting.
Sure.
She wants to also grow flowers.
Mm-hmm.
Are there specific flowers you can plant in your vegetable garden that will assist in deterring pests?
So deterring pests, I kind of think about it, Katie, quite frankly, in my own vegetable garden, and I have this kind of potager style thing going on, attracting beneficial insects
okay.
instead of deterring pests
yeah,
so
that's
much.
More positive.
How about that?
It's glass half full.
Yeah, because haven't you heard that umbel-shaped herbs, for example, attract a lot of beneficial insects?
I just like to hear you say umbel-shaped herbs.
Well, what's an umbel-shaped, umbel-flowering type herb?
Well, it'd be like a fennel, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing here, of course.
Yeah.
Fennel, dill.
Right.
Cilantro.
How
all am I
those.
Doing?
Yeah, and like that umbel shape, kind of like Queen Anne's lace.
Oh, umbel.
So, umbel,
I gotcha.
Right. So the flower looks like a little flat umbel.
Like an umbrella.
Umbrella, right.
Umbella.
But a little more flat.
Yeah.
So you get like hoverflies that like that those flowers. You get certain little parasitic wasps. That,
okay.
You know, so you're attracting the beneficial insects. So I would, but unfortunately, they're also the herbs that, also reseed themselves pretty well. So you got to be mindful not to have your garden taken over. But they are. They're great. It's a great herb to use in the kitchen, and they attract beneficial insects that will then in turn prey on some of those not so desirable
you
insects
go.
You may have in the
it's
garden.
It's the old full circle thing again.
That's right. Sure is.
If you have a full circle question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 814-8246. Miss Wishy, this has been what I would call a very tasteful,
mm-hmm.
educational,
mm-hmm.
even edible show here,
mm-hmm.
I think. And maybe there's some kind of finish to this we can have that would
I think,
kind
you
of
know,
wrap that up.
We can't talk about the history of agriculture without this word, because that's what it's all about, right?
Yep.
Nutrition, sure, but we want things to be edible
mm-hmm.
and tasty.
Absolutely.
So the Latin word of the week this week is esculentus, esculentum, or esculenta.
Edible or tasty.
Which means edible or tasty.
What a coincidence.
That's right. So I think the quintessential example of this
yeah.
is the garden tomato. Guess what the botanical name for the garden tomato is?
Esculente edible.
Yeah. Very, very close.
Close.
Lycopersicon esculentum.
I've never known that.
Right.
All these years.
Edible, tasty.
Perfect.
How about okra?
Yeah.
Abelmoscus esculentus.
Yeah. Okra, sure.
Okra.
Tasty.
Edible and tasty.
Yeah.
How about calocasia, which you like to grow?
I do.
Did you know that you could eat it as well, Bob?
Yeah.
Calocasia esculenta.
That fits the South American thing very
it
well.
It sure does. It's a taro root. You've heard of that before.
Yep.
Also called cocoa yam. Let's see. What else is esculenta?
I'm guessing maybe vegetable fern.
Have you ever eaten ferns? I actually haven't, but
no.
I know people do. Like the fiddleheads?
No.
Dipliasium esculentum, the vegetable fern.
I'll be darned.
Obviously, you can eat it,
yeah.
right? I guess if it's written down somewhere, the botanical name, that'll give you some sort of indication that you can
oh,
eat it.
I bet there's a restaurant on Market Street or Frankfort Avenue preparing that right now.
Yeah, otherwise you may be risking a little bit. Okay, how about this one? Back in the day, remember? I bet you ate tapioca when you were little.
I eat it now.
Tapioca, manihot,
yeah.
esculenta.
We had it last week.
Did you really?
Janet loves tapioca.
Huh, interesting.
Tapioca pudding.
Well, you can impress her with that. say, honey, can we have some manihot esculenta pudding?
Hey, she's got a manihot at home already.
She does. All right.
Fat
so
pitch.
I think that that's a really good word to know,
yeah.
Generally speaking, but certainly it'll tell us a little bit about the plants we may be considering eating. But esculentus, esculentum, or esculenta means edible, and tasty. So yeah, a sure thing for the dinner table.
I'll be right home, huh?
All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, the All-America selections and an update on the emerald ash borer and its treatments. There is some new information.
Homegrown is produced by the always tasteful Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.